LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Rick Strassman, who joins us to discuss his book, DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, A New Science of Spiritual Revelation in the Hebrew Bible. After completing his groundbreaking research chronicled in DMT, the Spirit Molecule, Strassman was left with one fundamental question. What does it mean that DMT, a simple chemical naturally found in all our bodies, instantaneously opens up to us an interactive spirit world that feels more real than our own world? When his decades of clinical psychiatric research and Buddhist practice were unable to provide answers to this question, Strassman began searching for a more resonant spiritual model. He found that the visions of the Hebrew prophets such as Ezekiel, Moses, Adam, and Daniel were strikingly similar to those of the volunteers in his DMT studies. Carefully examining the concept of prophecy in the Hebrew Bible, he characterizes a prophetic state of consciousness and explains how it may share biological and metaphysical mechanisms with the DMT effect. Examining medieval commentaries on the Hebrew Bible, Strassman reveals how Jewish metaphysics provides a top-down model for both the prophetic and DMT states, a model he calls theoneurology. Theoneurology bridges biology and spirituality by proposing that the divine communicates with us using the brain, and DMT, whether naturally produced or ingested, is a critical factor in such visionary experience. This model provides a counterpoint to neurotheology, which proposes that altered brain function simply generates the impression of a divine human encounter. Theoneurology addresses issues critical to the full flowering of the psychedelic drug experience. Perhaps even more importantly, it points the way to a renewal of classical prophetic consciousness, the soul of Hebrew Bible prophecy, as well as unexpected directions for the evolution of contemporary spiritual practice. Hello and welcome, Rick, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, thanks for having me on your show today, Greg.
Rick, today we're going to talk about your latest book, which is entitled DMT and the Soul of Prophecy. Subtitle is A New Science of Spiritual Revelation in the Hebrew Bible. Before we dive into that, just tell listeners a bit about your background and your work and how you became interested in psychedelics in the first place.
I guess I had an academic background, which involved the public schools in Los Angeles, and then undergraduate training on the West Coast. I was always interested in psychedelic research, or I became interested in psychedelic research during my college days and decided that the best way to pursue that was in medical school. So I attained my MD on the East Coast and then returned to the West Coast. So I completed my training in general psychiatry and then got some additional training in psychopharmacology research, which then enabled me to do some studies of pineal melatonin in humans and then to branch out into the DMT work. In terms of my interest in psychedelics, as I mentioned, it kind of began during my undergraduate days when I was really struck with the descriptions of the psychedelic drug state, both within the academic community and among my friends in school. It seemed like you could take a small amount of LSD, for example, and attain all kinds of incredible visions and insights and out-of-body experiences, those kinds of things. At around the same time, there was this influx of Eastern meditation techniques, which also promised the same kinds of effects, maybe not quite as spectacular, but at least qualitatively in the same ballpark. And so that began me considering the common biological denominators that might underlie, you know, both, you know, syndromes. It, you know, seemed to me that perhaps, you know, there was, you know, something in the brain that was activated or turned on by both by both specific meditation practices and by the psychedelic drugs. So that kind of got me interested in the pineal as a spiritual organ, and then DMT as a naturally occurring potential spiritual kind of molecule. From my own religious kind of background, which I guess would comprise my background in general, I was raised in a Jewish, you know, household in you know, Southern California in the 1950s and 60s, and then branched out, I guess, so to speak, or you know, left the fold and embarked upon a 20-plus year course of practice and study of Zen Buddhism, and you know, Zen a lot more than Judaism at the time, anyway, influenced my spiritual, you know, mindset with which I approached the DMT research.
Yes, and listeners may know of you from, as I say, your book, previous book, the DMT, the Spirit Molecule, and that documents some experimental work that you did, and that was quite pioneering, really, at the time. I'm not sure if what the current state of psychedelic research is, but certainly that was groundbreaking work that you undertook.
Yeah, you know, there's, well, let's see. So I studied DMT between 1990 and 1995. And at the time, that was the first new study with humans with these drugs in the U.S. in a generation. And I completed those studies, I guess, almost 20 years ago now. And in the meantime, there's been quite a resurgence of clinical research with these substances. There's a group at Imperial College in the UK, for example, studying LSD and psilocybin. There's Spanish studies of ayahuasca. There's a lot of studies in the U.S. using psilocybin. There's only been one study giving pure DMT since my study finished up. And that was a paper that was a study described in a paper from Germany that came out in, I think, 2005 or so.
Now, perhaps when turning to discuss your new book, we should say, basically give listeners the underlying premise, because it's quite an original one, to say the least, and also perhaps say something about neurotheology versus theoneurology, which again kind of underpins the main idea of the book.
Yeah. So after I completed my study, I was puzzled on a number of accounts, based on the reports from my volunteers. On one hand, I was expecting the Buddhist enlightenment experience as the peak effect of a high dose of DMT. And the enlightenment experience within Buddhism is a content-free, formless, ego-free state. The sense of self dissolves into the white light. There's no content. There's no time or space. There's no sense of self. It's nonverbal, non-perceptual. And in the case of my DMT volunteers, it was full of content, and it was extremely interactive, and the sense of self was maintained quite firmly, quite strongly, and one's ability to maneuver and interact with that state was intact, if not even more intact than usual. In addition, I was expecting the volunteers to appraise the state as a drug-induced state. Like with respect to LSD or psilocybin, one is aware of having taken a drug, and no matter how, far out there, one still is able to, distinguish between reality and the state that the drug induces. But in the case of DMT, the volunteers almost uniformly, instead of describing the state as less real than real or drug-induced, they felt it was as real or even more so, than everyday reality. And it was in that way extremely different than other drug states, dreams, hypnosis, any other kinds of subjective effects that they had undergone previously from any other technology. So those, were the two, phenomenological, kinds of questions facts that emerged from the study that weren't consistent with my preconceptions. So I started looking around for other models, than the Buddhist model, or the brain chemistry model, or even the psychological model, contextualize the DMT experience. And I was looking for models, which could, describe the reality basis, of the state, or that, extremely strong, feeling of reality, in addition, to the contentful, nature of the experience. So I began, looking at other scientific models, for example, those of dark matter, parallel universes, those kinds of things. So that still didn't quite answer the more overarching question, which was, what these states are good for, and, why the system is configured in, such a way, that this naturally occurring compound in the body, when given in, higher than normal doses in an experiment, could transport people into this particular experience of perceiving an alternate, freestanding, parallel level of reality. There was the reality basis, which all three of my previous models discounted. The brain chemistry model describes the DMT effect as your brain on drugs. The psychological model, posits, that these are just, visualizations of unconscious processes. And the Buddhist model, proposes, that the visions are, kind of detritus, being shed on the way towards the formless enlightened state. So some of the newer, models, within physics were able to, mechanistically explain the, possibility of freestanding realities, but didn't quite, tap into the existential reason, for their existence, or, why DMT in the body could provide that. And also what the states are good for, in other words, if DMT could provide access to other realms, then so what, more or less. I then, decided to turn, to the religious, traditions, which have also, looked at invisible worlds, but they've also tried to extract, meanings and, messages, from those invisible worlds, in order to obtain ethical information, theological information, those kinds of things. I've already discussed, some of the shortcomings, of Buddhism. Latin American, shamanism also, occupies itself with these, kinds of questions, but, it isn't, quite ready for prime time within the larger Western culture. So then I started thinking about returning to my own roots and began reading the Hebrew Bible. And, the notion of the prophetic state, began to emerge.
Yes, you mentioned shamanic tradition there, and there's a lot of talk these days about ayahuasca, and, there's such a thing as ayahuasca tourism now, which I'm sure you're aware of. But since really, its advent in the 60s, the Western psychedelic experience, as you pointed out, has kind of lacked meaning. A lot of psychedelic experience has been done for recreational reasons, basically. And that's something that comes across very strongly in your work, is that there is meaning here in this experience, but, you know, how to extract it, how to interpret the experience.
Yeah, you know, it's quite interesting. You know, up until perhaps, you know, 10 years ago, it was the Buddhist or Eastern religious model, which, you know, people used to frame, to integrate, to understand, to extract any information, you know, from their psychedelic states. If, you know, they were looking for a spiritual model, you know, for that, you know, for those purposes. You know, if you go into any head shop, you know, there's statues of Buddhas, and Bodhisattvas, and there's Tibetan, you know, bells, you know, there's posters of mandalas and those kinds of things. And, you know, the last, you know, several years, I would imagine, although it's been a long time since they've gone into a head shop, you know, that there would be, you know, the comparable, you know, paraphernalia, you know, within the Latin American shamanic context, you know, bells and rattles and whistles and, you know, posters of the Amazon. And if you go to Burning Man, and you have a bad experience on a psychedelic, you know, drug, you go to the Zendo to chill. And, you know, the Zendo is the Buddhist meditation hall in a Zen monastery. You know, so it's just, you know, kind of, you know, crept into the lay culture, the popular, you know, culture that, you know, the only way to frame these experiences, if you're looking at them from a spiritual perspective, is with a, you know, non-Western model. Or at least a non-modern Western model, or a you know, non-traditional Western model. You know, so, well, and, you know, for example, you know, why isn't the, you know, chilling off place in Burning Man called, you know, the temple or the tabernacle or the tent of meeting? So I think it's become unconsciously kind of integrated into the contemporary, you know, psychedelic subculture. You know, it isn't only in the psychedelic subculture, though. It's also, you know, seeped into the academic study of these drugs. You know, because, if you look at any of the research which is going on, you know, with these substances in humans, you know, all of them are kind of geared towards expecting and coach their volunteers or their subjects to experience the unitive state, you know, the unitive mystical state, where everything is one, the ego dissolves, there's the white light, there's no content, it all feels fantastic, everything makes sense, but there's no verbal content to speak of. You know, so I think the academic world has also been co-opted, with the Eastern, you know, New Age model, as it were, as opposed, you know, to the interactive, you know, relational, contentful, experience, which, is the underlying one of the Bible, which is the which is the foundational text, you know, for half of the world's population.
Yeah, I think it, particularly in the West, I mean, that the mainline religions, particularly Christianity, they become so tainted in many people's minds. So we're very disengaged, you know, from religion, more people than ever declaring, you know, I know the situation is somewhat different in the US, but more people than ever declaring themselves not religious, that any idea that there could be any connection between this sort of profound experience and anything that goes on in a church, it just seems to be, you know, worlds apart.
Well, yeah, and, you know, that's a good point. You know, what goes on in a church is worlds apart. But, you know, that is because of what's been done, you know, to the texts. They've been interpreted and used, you know, for the purposes of the institutions, which, you know, survive on and rely upon the authority of the text, you know, for their existence. You know, in my current work, I'm primarily referring to the Hebrew Bible, as opposed, you know, to the more, you know, recent developments that have grown around it, for example, Talmud and Midrash and the rabbinic tradition and Kabbalah and all those things. Because I think as a result of getting, further from the text, you get further from the tradition or, you know, from the foundation. And, you know, the foundation of the texts is, usually, you know, built around, you know, the religious experience of the founder. You know, in the case of the Hebrew Bible, you're looking at a text, you know, that was, which was either received and or, you know, laid down within a prophetic state of mind. You know, so if you read the text and you resonate, you know, with it, you know, theoretically, you would be resonating with the state of mind out of which the text emerged in the first place. And when you start getting into, you know, the minutiae of the rituals which the church, or, you know, the later institutional accretions, have, you know, developed, you get further from that state and you get, you know, more into the politics and the authority and greed and, you know, violence and, you know, those kinds of problems.
Yeah, just for listeners who are not aware, and we're referring to the Hebrew Bible, we're talking about the Old Testament, which is sort of more popularly known.
Right. That's a good point. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, it's quite all right. I mean, you're correct, but just for so people have got something to hang this on. Now, I have not read very much of the Bible at all. Maybe some passages that we did during religious education at school, but I do have one friend, and she read all of the Old Testament because she was interested, just because so few people do it. You know, so people ever bother. And she was struck mainly by the darkness, the violence, and this notion of a vengeful God and how contradictory it was. But you address some of this in your book.
Yeah. So there's a, you know, number of issues, you know, which are involved in, in any attempt, you know, to read and understand the Bible. Well, you know, first of all is the issue of translation. You know, most of the English translations of the Hebrew Bible, which are in circulation, are translated by Christians. You know, so, you know, well, the Hebrew Bible is written in Hebrew, and there's no vowels, there's no accents, there's no punctuation. You know, so one's translation of the text is, you know, necessarily an interpretation. It isn't, you know, strictly speaking, an exact translation. It's an interpretation because you have to pick and choose among, the various options, you know, for how to translate certain words, how to punctuate, the sentences, and, you know, how to vowelize the consonants. You know, so that's, you know, one thing of, you know, great importance is, you know, the nature of the translation. You know, for example, you know, Christian Bibles or, you know, Christian, you know, translations of the Hebrew Bible are being undertaken with the assumption, you know, that Jesus was the Messiah. And, you know, that kind of, you know, takes into a whole ball of wax. In other words, you know, humans are not able to approach God, you know, individually on their own, you know, that it requires the, intermediation of a Messiah figure. And, you know, that isn't at all implied or explicit in the Hebrew Bible. Also, a Christian interpretation or translation of the Bible would be reading quite a few of the predictions and the allegories in the Hebrew Bible as foretelling the birth and resurrection and crucifixion of Jesus. And, you know, so none of that is implicit in the Hebrew Bible either. And when you are thinking about a vengeful God or an angry God, you know, it's important to interpret, well, it's important to, you know, be able, you know, to have access, you know, to commentaries on the text. It's an extraordinarily, you know, difficult, you know, text, you know, to penetrate. It would almost be like somebody opening up a book of surgery and, you know, reading, you know, the procedures and seeing the photographs and thinking, this is completely nuts. You're cutting people open and taking out their organs? That makes no sense at all. And you would just be angry and you'd close it. You know, as opposed to if you started in college and you learned some anatomy and biology, you went to medical school and, you know, learned about pathology, you know, pharmacology, those kinds of things, you know, then you became a, you know, surgical resident. You know, so you really, you know, need to start with the basics when you're looking at the Hebrew Bible, and you need to educate yourself in reading it and understanding where it comes from. And in, you know, my, case. I, learned about the medieval Jewish, philosophers and, commentators, who lived between, the turn of the Common Era and around 1600 or so. So they, exert themselves, mightily in, helping you understand what the individual words mean, or what the sentences mean, the context. They explain, things that don't make sense or their contradictions. One of, the concepts, that they, present or teach is, that of reward and punishment, as described in the Bible. And they, point out, that God, as the creator and sustainer of existence, created both the natural laws of the universe and the moral laws of the universe. And within, the natural laws, you can see the operation of, cause and effect. If you throw a match into a dry, forest, it'll start on fire. So that's, cause and effect. You wouldn't, cause, or you wouldn't call that, punishment by God for misbehaving. Although if you were living, 10,000 years ago, you might. So it, partakes of this notion called anthropomorphizing. You apply human features to non-human things. So, for example, if you're angry at, somebody and you stub your toe and you hurt, are you being punished, for having the angry thought? Or is it, simply the manifestation of a very, complex, net of cause and effect? So I started to think about the notion of God actually within the Buddhist context of the world of cause and effect. Cause and effect is supposed to be impersonal. Things are now because of how things were before. But if you look, more carefully at everyday life, cause and effect, seems geared, towards encouraging certain behaviors and discouraging others. So for example, if I'm angry at somebody, why doesn't that, cause me to grow an extra nose, for example, as opposed to stubbing my toe? So you could explain how me being angry might allow me to grow an extra nose, but that wouldn't really, explain, why things are, set up that way. But, things are, set up in a specific way, that if you are angry, you stub your toe and it discourages you from being angry. So in quite a few ways, it's, comparable, to the natural law. There are, causes of effects, but, within the, social, theological, interactive kind of world, you look at them as moral laws rather than natural laws. But ultimately, they're the same thing, it seems to me. And you're just, putting human terms on, moral, or, well, you're putting human terms on the operation of, cause and effect. In other words, if I got angry and I stubbed my toe, one could, it's easier to look upon that as an example of being, punished, for having a bad thought. And, God is an angry, punishing God. But at the same time, if you dissect it, you could look at it as, the consequence of a, vast array of invisible, but, just as real moral laws as the ones, which regulate nature.
Yeah, it's this idea of karma, isn't it? And I think that people like to talk these days, moral relativism, but I think people innately, I think as human beings, we understand the difference between good and evil. And it's not, we can't say that, oh, well, it depends on your perspective. I think underlying that, there is something, and even something meaningful. And even I've talked to quite hardened atheists who will grudgingly acknowledge that there does seem to be some kind of law in operation. It might not happen to an evildoer in this lifetime, but what goes around comes around. It's just something that seems inherent to us, religious or not.
Right. And well, that whole concept of what, goes around comes around, Yeah, you know, that is a convenient, you know, way to express an exceedingly, you know, complex, you know, web of interactions, at the spiritual level, at the moral level, at the interpersonal level, you know, psychologically, you know, socially, you know, but ultimately, yeah, it is cause and effect. I mean, you can personalize, you know, cause and effect. I mean, you can get angry at the vengeful, you know, match for starting a fire. But, you know, that, you know, wouldn't make sense. You know, so the whole concept of reward and punishment is a, you know, convenient, you know, simplification. But, I think it stirs up all kinds of reactions, you know, similar, to the one that you described your friend went through. So it is a vast area, but I think if you can, number one, step away from things a bit, and number two, you know, think about, you know, the notion of anthropomorphizing, you know, phenomena. In other words, you know, putting human, you know, traits or activities around, otherwise impersonal kinds of, you know, behaviors.
Now, the core of your book is you have drawn comparisons between the prophetic state as laid down in the Hebrew Bible and the DMT, the psychedelic experience. Now, first of all, perhaps I could just get you to say something about prophecy, because again, for most people, that's exclusively predicting the future, and it's not as simple as that. And obviously, you can't go through all the different comparisons that you made in the book, but perhaps you can maybe touch upon some of the categories that you used and just say something general about what conclusions you drew.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so that is a good point about my definition of the prophetic state or of, you know, prophecy. Yeah. Because most people think of, you know, prophecy as predicting or foretelling, you know, but that is an artifact of translation once more. You know, the Greek translation of the Bible or the Hebrew Bible, it's, you know, called the Septuagint. It chose to translate the Hebrew word Navi into prophetes. You know, so Navi is the Hebrew word for prophet. And, you know, if you look at the root of Navi, it means interpreter, explainer, communicator, that kind of, idea. And if you look at the root of prophetes, which is the Greek translation of Navi, it means, you know, someone that foretells the future. And, you know, that's because, you know, for the Greeks, the spiritual experience was used primarily, you know, for foretelling. But, you know, the Hebrew word, you know, more refers to the spokesman-like, you know, properties of the Hebrew prophet. He or she is a spokesman for God as opposed to a, you know, predictor of future events. You know, one of the indicators of a true versus false, you know, prophet is predicting, but, you know, false prophets can predict, and there are other ways, you know, to accurately, you know, predict, you know, without using prophecy. Like, you know, for example, if you're a, you know, meteorologist, you can predict the future with a, you know, fair degree of accuracy. You know, so, if you expand the notion of being a prophet or the prophetic state, you know, to encompass any spiritual experience as recorded as taking place in a figure in the Hebrew Bible, any visions, any voices, any inspiration, any new ideas, you know, physical, you know, feelings, emotional states, out of body experiences, you know, the kinds of things which, you know, people include in any, you know, full definition of spiritual experience, you know, if you expand the definition of the prophetic state in that way, you know, takes it out of the realm of, you know, the canonical prophets like Ezekiel and Isaiah, Jeremiah, and extends it into anyone who encounters any, you know, spiritual kind of, you know, subjective experience, you know, within the text.
And of course, the one conclusion to take away from this is that if there are genuine similarities here between these two states, then perhaps there's a new lens with which to view the psychedelic experience today. And perhaps rather than some, you know, wacky visions and visuals, there might be meaning in there, as I mentioned earlier, if we can find a new way to understand the experience.
Yeah, I mean, your question about the comparison is germane. You know, because when I first, you know, came across, you know, this idea of comparing the prophetic state and the DMT state, I was mostly struck with the phenomenological, you know, similarities. You know, for example, there's quite a few, you know, visual phenomena in the prophetic state. You know, the colors, are, you know, seen, which are comparable, you know, to the colors in the DMT state. Blues, reds, yellows, oranges. They're intensely saturated, which occurs in both states. They're rapidly moving. There's quite a bit of, you know, fire described in the visions of the Hebrew Bible, which are, you know, comparable to the swirling, pulsating, shifting, you know, visions in the DMT experience. In the beginning of the, you know, prophetic state, you know, there's a sound like a whistle or, you know, like a rushing of waters. And, you know, that's also quite, you know, similar to what occurs, in the onset of the DMT experience. You know, there's out of body experiences in both states. There's fear. There's anxiety. You know, there's a lot more ecstasy, I suppose, in the DMT effect than the prophetic one. But that may, you know, be more related, you know, to the message which is contained in the prophetic state, which is often, you know, kind of, you know, gloomy, as compared, you know, to the more, you know, for example, generic, you know, psychological, you know, message which occurred in the DMT volunteers. You know, there can be, you know, shaking in both states. You know, the visions, you know, can include the experience of eyes, you know, for example, in Ezekiel's, you know, vision, you know, the beings are, you know, covered with eyes on their wings. And, you know, there are eyes in the DMT visions as well. You know, if you want to, you know, get a quick, you know, hit of the, you know, similarities between the DMT effect and those of a, you know, bona fide, you know, prophet in the Bible, the first, you know, book of Ezekiel, is a great place to start. It's an extremely psychedelic, you know, description of Ezekiel's initiatory vision. You know, but as I compared, you know, the two states, you know, more carefully, you know, they seem to be different, as well as being, you know, comparable. You know, they shared a lot of similarities when it came, you know, to the content, you know, to the visions and the voices and the physical feelings, you know, but, you know, there was one specific issue or one specific category which, you know, began to become clear as I compared the states more carefully. And I call that relatedness. In other words, it was a description of the nature of the interactions, between the person having the experience and the contents of the experience. In the case of the Bible, it was interactions between the prophet and God or God's angels. In the case of the DMT effect, it was the interactions between the volunteer and the beings that they encountered, in the DMT state. And these beings, you know, could, you know, take any, you know, form or shape. You know, they could be humans or humanoid. They could be like robots. They could be plants, insects, reptiles, you know, mammals, birds, even furniture, even geometric objects. You know, so as I started, you know, comparing the nature of, you know, the relationships, described in the prophetic state compared to the DMT one, you know, the prophetic states, you know, began to look a lot, you know, more superior, as it were, you know, a lot more refined, complex, sophisticated. You know, the nature of, you know, the interactions were, you know, much, you know, more, you know, highly articulated and well developed, you know, than in, you know, the DMT effect. You know, so as I looked even closer, it, you know, seemed, you know, that the, you know, main, you know, function, of, you know, the relationship, in either of these states was the communication of information. And when I started to, you know, compare, you know, the information content of the two states, you know, then the prophetic one, you know, seemed even more superior in, you know, terms of the profundity of the kinds of information that people in the prophetic state, you know, returned with. You know, if you look at the, the prophetic message, it's endured for thousands of years. It's influenced every level of Western civilization, law, ethics, morality, you know, theology, science, philosophy, you know, finance, economics, poetry, wisdom, architecture. I mean, everything. But if you look at the, you know, message content of, you know, the DMT, or maybe not the DMT state, but, you know, as a specific example of the psychedelic state, its influence has been, you know, primarily, the realm of aesthetics. Even the computer, you know, revolution isn't really an advance in human, you know, wisdom. It's an advance in, you know, technology, and it's pretty, and it makes you, you know, it can be inspiring. But in, you know, terms of, you know, the verbal information which has come down, it isn't anything new. And as you know, we were talking about earlier, it's mostly been interpreted or, you know, couched in, you know, New Age and Eastern religious vocabularies and, you know, concepts and images. You know, so, you know, that, you know, gets around to answering your question or addressing, you know, the point that you made about, you know, the text, you know, the Hebrew Bible can, you know, provide a lens or an interpretive key to extracting information, you know, from, you know, the psychedelic state. And it also can help, you know, prepare somebody for entering into it. If you learn about the nature of relationships between the prophet and between angels, or, you know, between the prophet and angels, or between the prophet and God, you know, you can learn how to interact with the beings, for example, in the DMT state. You can learn how to ask questions. You can learn, you know, to recognize what you're seeing. You can learn how to, understand what's being told to you, those kinds of things. And if you're prepared to, enter into that state with, you know, more background, you know, more knowledge, which is consistent with your background, your upbringing, your culture, you know, perhaps even your genetics, I think you might be better equipped, you know, to extract valuable information, you know, from your psychedelic experiences.
I think such experiences do change people forever. I mean, in my experience, that's the case. But the only thing that, again, just speaking from my own experience, that people seem to take away from it is they'll talk about, it's almost a cliche now, about the interconnectedness of everything. So they'll come away with a sense of that, and it does affect, you know, how people choose to live, I think.
Yeah, I agree. But still, you know, that's kind of, you know, kindergarten understanding in, you know, some ways, or, it, you know, like it's, it, you know, like it's true, but, you know, 2 and 2 equals 4 is true as well. But, you know, that isn't, you know, the same as, you know, calculus or, you know, like a more sophisticated, more applicable, use or actualization, of spiritual insights. You know, you can look around and determine that, you know, things are interconnected, and you can feel that at a deeper level, through meditation or through the psychedelic, you know, direct state, you know, but what do you do with that? And, you know, for example, you know, there's the golden rule, and, you know, the golden rule, is a revealed, you know, truth. If you believe the Jewish, you know, tradition, it is, you know, one that wouldn't be otherwise, attainable, you know, through thinking about it simply. You would need to be told it, you know, from an outside source, you know, like a spiritual outside source, you know, and okay, you know, things are interconnected, you know, so that would lead you to investigate or you know, or discover the golden rule. And, you know, once you learn about the golden rule, you can then, you know, look at the application of the golden rule within the context of, for example, you know, Jewish law as, you know, laid out in the Hebrew Bible. You know, there are quite a few, you know, laws and, you know, regulations which, you know, concern themselves, you know, with interactions, you know, between humans and humans and between humans and the natural world. And all of those devolve, you know, from a deep understanding of the golden rule. You know, like another, you know, common, you know, takeaway that, you know, people get from the psychedelic, you know, drug state is, you know, that all is one. And, you know, that is true. But, you know, what do you do with that exactly? And you can look at the text of the Hebrew Bible, and you could look at his description of God as one. And, you know, then, you know, that could start on, you know, and, you know, so that could then start you on the route to understanding what that means and, you know, how that would affect your relationship with God, as God interacts with the world, you know, in, terms of how you know, God, you know, created and sustains the world as it is right now. You know, so you might be able to begin with those insights that you attain on the psychedelic, you know, drug state, which are, you know, kind of simple. And, you know, then you can develop them into a more, complex, you know, fulsome, you know, way of interacting with the material and the spiritual worlds.
Pure speculation here, but just thinking about the prophetic experience with regards to DMT, do you ever consider if it was possible, I mean, how would we ever verify this, but that the pineal gland could have been more active in the past?
Well, you're speaking, you know, to, you know, the issue of the pineal as being a, you know, source of endogenous or, you know, naturally produced DMT. And, you know, it's important to, you know, point out that the lungs are the primary source of DMT. You know, that's been known for, you know, 50, almost 60 years probably by now.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know. You know, most people get, you know, interested in the pineal gland for a number of reasons and then, you know, kind of, you know, forget about the lungs as, you know, the primary source of DMT. Yeah, and I had speculated about the, you know, presence or the production of DMT in the pineal in my first DMT book, you know, but it was pure speculation at the time. You know, thankfully, within the last, you know, couple of years, a new study demonstrated the presence of DMT in the pineal. So, you know, that, you know, theorizing has been, you know, validated. You know, but even if you don't have a pineal gland or even if it's, you know, primarily, you know, quiescent, you know, there are the lungs. And it, you know, could be that people in the prophetic state were in the throes of a higher than normal level of DMT in their bodies. And I think, you know, that makes sense to the extent that the two phenomena resemble each other. You know, to the extent that the naturally occurring prophetic state shares features with the state brought on by giving DMT, you can speculate that there must be some, you know, some common underlying, you know, denominator. And, you know, that could be, you know, simply enough, an increased amount of DMT in the body of the prophet, or perhaps an increased, you know, sensitivity, you know, to, you know, the DMT that's normally there, in the body of the prophet. You know, but even if that were the case, you know, that only explains the content, of the states, the DMT state or the prophetic state. It doesn't concern itself with, you know, two other questions. You know, one is, you know, why is the, activity of DMT in the prophet or somebody experiencing the prophetic state, you know, greater? And, also, it, you know, doesn't, you know, concern itself, you know, with the message content, you know, with the information which is being, beheld or apprehended, within the altered state. you know, in our studies, it's clear that the increase in DMT was the result of the infusion of the drug, you know, through the vein into their system. In the case of the prophetic experience, I'm speculating, you know, that stimulation comes, you know, from above rather than from below. And, you know, that, you know, kind of speaks, you know, to the difference between, you know, theoneurology, which is a top-down model, and, you know, neurotheology, which is a bottom-up, you know, kind of model. In the top-down model, it's God who ultimately is, you know, the final arbiter of, you know, who attains the prophetic state. And it would, you know, be through spiritual influence, you know, from the outside, on to the person, you know, that would increase, you know, the activity of the DMT in the system in the person. And also the content, would be, you know, transmitted, you know, from the outside as well, as it were. You know, but at the same time, there's, you know, this notion of the imaginary, you know, faculty and of the rational faculty. You know, the contents of the DMT and prophetic state are played out in the rational faculty. You know, the rational faculty is what's, you know, considered the intellect. It's in the more abstract ideas as opposed to the, you know, feelings and the perceptions and, you know, the bodily effects, which are contained in the realm of the imaginative, you know, faculty. And I'm not speaking of imaginative, you know, faculty as, you know, made up. I'm more, you know, thinking of it as, you know, the contents, of the body, as it were. According to the medievalists, you know, based on Aristotle, you know, the imaginative is the more, you know, physical, of the two faculties. You know, so DMT in, you know, my conception, you know, the metaphysics of DMT, as it were, you know, would state, you know, that DMT is stimulating the imagination. It enhances the production of these, you know, visions and these voices and, you know, so on. According, you know, to the medievalists, you need to have an extremely well-developed or extremely, you know, high-functioning imaginative faculty and rational faculty. And you really aren't able to stimulate, you know, the rational faculty in any other way, you know, than through education and through training and through practice. And in the prophetic state, you know, there's, you know, the downflow or the spiritual efflux, as it were, you know, from God or, you know, from divinity, you know, which is activating a, you know, highly developed, you know, rational faculty and imaginative, you know, faculty. You know, so in the case of giving DMT, you know, from below, you know, there isn't any, you know, compensation made for, or there isn't any, or, you know, there isn't any stimulation of the rational faculty. You know, so the volunteers were, you know, they were using their intellect to extract whatever information, you know, that they could, you know, from the DMT state, you know, but they were kind of, you know, limited, you know, as a result of their models. And in, you know, the prophetic experience, you know, one is, you know, pious, you know, believes in God, wants to serve God, has, you know, perfected and, you know, developed their intellect, you know, so, you know, when their intellect, is, you know, called upon to extract information of the visions, which are residing in the imaginative, you know, faculty, it's able, you know, it's, you know, able to do so, in a, you know, more exacting, you know, more sophisticated manner.
Thinking practically about these sort of experiences, there's a couple of ideas that you take into consideration. Again, very speculative, but absolutely fascinating. Thinking about the objective reality that people feel that is inherent in this experience, you ask the question, okay, where might this be if it's an objective reality? And you point out, of course, that we've lost over 95% of the universe into dark energy and dark matter. There might be something in there. And also, if there's an objective reality here, is it possible for us to, I think you used the term to capture an image of it. Is there some way that someone else could experience it apart from the, you know, the person actually undergoing the experience? I'm reminded of the film, I don't know if you've seen it, this movie called Brainstorm, where they devise this apparatus to capture people's subjective experiences. And they capture things like an orgasm and other sort of, you know, meaningful experiences. And they also eventually end up capturing someone's death, which turns out to be disastrous. But it's, I say, high octane speculation, but really, really fascinating.
Yeah. It would be interesting if one, you know, could develop, for example, a, you know, camera which is able to capture images of dark matter or, you know, parallel universes. You know, because if indeed, you know, dark matter is, you know, 90% of, you know, the mass of the universe, you know, there isn't any reason to believe that it isn't inhabited, or, you know, that there aren't, you know, things in it which, you know, can be seen if you've got the, you know, proper, you know, perceptual apparatus. You know, so it would be of interest, you know, at, you know, some point in the future, you know, to develop, for example, a dark matter camera, you know, capture images and then, you know, compare those, you know, to the DMT state images. And yeah, and if, you know, they were similar, I mean, obviously that would be some, you know, some objective, you know, validation, of, you know, the existence and the nature of the DMT world. If it didn't, you know, comport, I don't think it would, you know, prove anything, because, you know, there are obviously, a large number of, you know, parallel universes out there. But still, if, you know, they did comport, you know, you would have hit the jackpot. But, you know, I'm at the same time, I don't think, you know, our inability to capture, I don't think that our inability to capture objective images, you know, should necessarily inhibit our interest in these states, because, you know, people have been, you know, looking at, you know, dreams for, well, you know, for thousands of years. You know, nobody's, you know, has, you know, taken a picture of, you know, somebody else's dream, you know. So in, you know, some ways there is no objective reality to dreams because it's a purely subjective experience. But at, you know, the same time, you know, billions of people have talked about their dreams. You know, there's a, you know, consistency, you know, to dreams, you know, so, you know, that, I mean, still, you know, provides the access, you know, to the dream state, to study associated phenomenon, to, you know, look at the contents, you know, for all kinds of reasons.
Can I just get your thoughts on the legal situation with regard to psychedelics as it stands now? Because obviously it's been in flux for some time, and I was disturbed actually to learn a couple of weeks ago, I had a guest on, we were talking about psilocybin and mushrooms, and I hadn't been aware until that point that they were actually made illegal in the UK and as recently as 2005. And I can't think why, what would have been behind that. You know, there wasn't any upsurgence in, you know, this stuff in the news. And so that's very discouraging. But as you pointed out, there is psychedelic research still ongoing, and we hear regular news stories now from the US about laws around cannabis being lifted. So, I mean, in general, I suppose that has to be considered good news.
Well, yeah, these compounds all in the US anyway reside in what's called Schedule 1, which is the most restrictive legal category. And, you know, it's kind of ironic or kind of strange is, you know, that the criteria for a drug to be placed in schedule, you know, in that schedules, you know, schedule one is, you know, that the drug is highly abusable, you know, cannot be used, you know, safely even under medical supervision and has got, you know, known, you know, medical use. You know, so in the case of, you know, the psychedelics, I suppose, you know, it is possible to, you know, make an argument that these drugs, you know, can be abused. But, you know, compared to other abusable, you know, drugs, it's, you know, isn't anywhere, you know, near as big a, you know, public health problem. But, you know, if you consider abuse, you know, taking a substance, you know, which incapacitates you, you know, you can't, you know, drive or operate heavy machinery, those kinds of things. I suppose, you know, psychedelics, you know, could be categorized as abusable. Still, I mean, even as, you know, far back as, you know, my DMT studies, which began in, you know, 1990, you know, the fact that I got, you know, federal, you know, permission and, you know, funding to do my work indicated that the drugs, you know, could be used, you know, safely under medical supervision. And also, you know, in the case of, you know, my study, you know, were being used for a medical purpose. In other words, to understand brain chemistry, you know, understand how these drugs work. And especially within the upsurge of, you know, clinical research with, you know, psilocybin, there are all, you know, kinds of, you know, data, you know, demonstrating that these drugs, you know, can be used, you know, safely under medical supervision. And, you know, they can be used for all kinds of reasons, you know, to treat OCD, to, you know, treat the anguish that's associated with, you know, terminal illness, you know, to treat alcohol abuse, you know, to treat, you know, cigarette dependence. You know, so I think, at some point, you know, that there's going to be either a rescheduling of these drugs into, you know, some place between one and two, you know, where they're still quite, you know, highly, you know, regulated, but, you know, can be used in specific, you know, circumstances or, you know, clinics, you know, by highly or specially, you know, trained people. But, you know, but they can't, you know, be as easily prescribable as, you know, for example, Valium or, you know, Xanax or, you know, those kinds of drugs. But, you know, I think it'll be, you know, sometime, you know, before, you know, there is a, you know, delegalization of the psychedelics, you know, that's going to be gaining any, you know, traction as, for example, in the case of marijuana.
Well, my just closing thought on this really is that before I ever had a psychedelic experience, I would marvel at the hypnagogic visions that I would have before going to sleep. And it, just a general thought is that nature doesn't do things for no reason or by accident. So there's somewhere in all of this, there's meaning which we've maybe yet to discover, or maybe we're rediscovering it.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, a lot of people ask me, you know, what is the purpose of DMT being in the body or in the, you know, thousands of plants, you know, that it's been found in. And, you know, if you look upon that question from a spiritual, you know, top down point of view, you can answer that question by, you know, saying it's the means that God, you know, has, it's the means that God has, you know, placed within our disposal or at our disposal, you know, to communicate with the divine, you know. So, you know, that is, you know, one answer, to the question of, you know, what is DMT, you know, doing in our bodies and in the plant world? It's, you know, the means of communicating with spiritual realities. And it was designed that way, because, you know, things want to know each other. If you look at it from the bottom up kind of model, though, you know, the neurotheological approach, you know, that can, explain, you know, the reason for things being, you know, so configured from the evolutionarily adaptive point of view. You know, for example, if you, enter into these states, you might be more altruistic or more, you know, creative. But still that kind of, you know, that kind of, you know, limits, the states, you know, to, you know, ones which, have got, you know, the human being as of the center of the universe. And if you look at, you know, the prophetic state, it isn't all, you know, good news. It isn't all happy. You know, it's oftentimes inexplicable. You know, sometimes it appears to go against, you know, common sense or evolution. You know, so, I think if you're looking at the source, you know, is it the brain or is it God? You know, the panorama diverges quite radically.
Rick, today we've been talking about your latest book, DMT and the Soul of Prophecy. That's available everywhere, easily tracked down. Just share folks' details of your website and anything else you'd like to put out there.
Well, sure. If you order the book, through my site, it's rickstrassman.com. I will inscribe it and autograph it. Or you can buy it on Amazon, anywhere, Barnes and Noble, or at your favorite, neighborhood, bookstore. It's interesting. If you walk into any bookstore, it's, kind of like my first, DMT book. It's, it can be hard to find. Sometimes it'll be in the New Age, section, sometimes the psychology section, sometimes in, psychedelics, or drugs, sometimes occult or metaphysics, so you might even have to ask for it, if you go into your local bookstore.
Excellent. Well, Rick, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were £7, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.